This is Pure Decking for May the 16th and 2013. This is a show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps, and tonight we have BSV, Madman, Sard, and the Suave. I am currently hurting my liver with my last bottle of Dragon's Milk. What are you guys drinking?
The Elixir of the Gods, Mountain Dew.
I actually have Angry Urchard Hard Cider.
Nice.
I have
a shock top.
No drinking on this end, because I am heavily medicated.
What, Madman, did you go beat up Sard and take his shock top?
I saw this apple shock top, and I saw a recipe for using apple cider and then on ribs, and then decided apple shock top could be good. So my ribs had some apple shock top, I had some apple shock top, everyone was happy.
Except for the ribs, I've had that stuff, it's good.
Except for the ribs being slow roasted there, I mean.
But at least they're slow roasted in alcohol.
Well, that's true. That's true. All right, well, I've got a little bit of station news. Lauren Law's Missing Dialogues is now doing his he's now doing his show live on the station on Tuesday nights. I'm wanting to say that was around 7 o'clock. When did it... Was anybody else on from this panel? I'm going to say about 7 o'clock. I'm not sure what time he actually went, so we'll get the schedule on the site updated sometime this millennium. And I don't really have much... I couldn't think of anything great for a discussion panel tonight, so I think I'm just going to go right ahead into news stories here. So, first one up. I didn't get any fantastic feedback. Sard, did you see anything in the feedback channel worth mentioning?
Nope, nothing yet.
Okay, fair enough. I was hoping for chicks in the wine rack brawl or whatever the hell it was we talked about at the end of that show.
Yeah, me too. Unfortunately, it never came.
Yeah. So, anyways, first one up. This one is from the H Online. Anyone who uses Skype has to... I'm sorry, let me start that again. Anyone who uses Skype has consented to the company reading everything they write. The H's associates in Germany at Heiss Security have now discovered that the Microsoft subsidy does in fact make use of this privilege in practice. Shortly after sending HTTPS URLs over the instant messaging service, those URLs receive an unannounced visit from Microsoft HQ in Redmond. A reader informed Heiss Security that he had observed some unusual network traffic following a Skype instant messaging conversation. The server indicated a potential replay attack. It turned out that an IP address, which was traced back to Microsoft, had accessed the HTTPS URL previously transmitted over Skype. Heiss Security then reproduced the events by sending two test HTTPS URLs, one containing login information and one pointing to a private cloud-based file sharing service. A few hours after their Skype messages, they observed the following in their server, and they've got the IP of 6552100214, and it was definitely using the... you know, it actually had in the HTML header the password that they had transmitted in Skype. And they, too, had received each of the HTTPS URLs transmitted over Skype from an IP address registered to Microsoft in Redmond. URLs pointing to encrypted web pages frequently contain unique session data or other confidential information. HTTP URLs, by contrast, were not accessed. In visiting these pages, Microsoft made use of both the login information and the specially created URL for a private cloud-based file sharing service. In response to an inquiry from Heiss Security, Skype referred them to a passage from its data protection policy. Skype may use automated scanning within instant messages and SMS to A, identify suspected spam, or B, identify URLs that have been previously flagged as spam, fraud, or phishing links. A spokesman for the company confirmed that it scans messages to filter out spam and phishing websites. This explanation does not appear to fit the facts, however. Spam and phishing sites are not usually fond of HTTPS pages. By contrast, Skype... I would contend that, actually. Most of... I've seen a lot of the a little fake, fill out this form, give us your password that are HTTPS. They usually do that to try to look more legit. So anyways, the story goes on about how Skype leaves HTTPS or HTTP URLs alone, but, raids the HTTPS ones, and then Skype has some history in this. So, right now they're obviously doing some kind of filtering on their instant messaging system, grabbing HTTPS URLs and testing them. The one thing I wish they explained a little bit better is whether or not the username and password were in the URL that was passed, or if it was just like, user colon, password colon, and then the URL.
Yeah, from what I was reading about that, that's what I understood it to be. Like, it was just, the username and password was in the URL, so it could have just been a bot or something like that. I'm sure it probably was a bot.
But, oh, yeah, it's got to be a bot. There's no way to... Yeah, we're going to pay 500 people to scan Skype messages. No, I don't think so.
Well, I always envisioned, some guy sitting in some server room, just sitting there beating off, watching all the, dirty Skype messages go through. I'm sure
picture the guy from South Park, the World of Warcraft player who had no life.
Yeah. That's
how do you
one.
Kill that which has no life? You have him
with
read
fire?
Skype messages.
I actually own a cap that says I read your email. I'm not entirely sure where it is, but I have one of those. And I'll tell you, as somebody who has spent time reading other people's email, it's pretty damned boring.
Oh, I'm sure.
So,
just need to find more interesting people to spy upon.
One would almost need to put together some sort of bot to go through all the messages and find all the interesting ones for you to read personally.
Like HTTPS URLs with logins and passwords in them, perhaps?
Hey, there's an idea.
I wonder if this is going to get me into any confidential company information. Possibly bank accounts or customer info.
Skype
wouldn't do anything like that.
Yeah, it's just curious that Skype is, actually hitting the URLs to see what they are. It very well could be that it's throwing them looking for malware and that they just picked HTTPS because it's less common, so it'd be a decent test. But the fact that they said it took a few hours for the URLs to be tested is interesting to me, too, because what good does that do to somebody you're trying to fish over Skype if a few hours later Microsoft checks it?
Good point.
So I'm not sure what they're doing there. Again, this is why Galaxy 15, for the most part, has moved away from Skype. We still use it here and there, but I know Laura's still pretty fond of it. But in general, they've been getting more and more scary pretty much ever since Microsoft bought them. So,
pretty much ever since Microsoft bought them, we've all been saying this is exactly what's going to be happening.
Yep.
And not
so
to say
we
to called
say
it,
it, but yeah, told you so.
So, yeah.
Really, like any major corporation that's doing this sort of stuff is going to be scanning through it. Same thing with Google. Like, you think that your stuff in Gmail is completely private? Yeah, they obviously they read it because they use it to custom tailor your ads. Now, I'm sure there's not an individual using that, but it's still being accessed.
I've got a Google story later on, don't worry. So, believe you me, you'll like it too. So, next one up I have, this one is from Ars Technica. Both Lore and RU had sent me this link, and I had actually seen it earlier that day as well, so I guess I better talk about it. That many people throwing it at me. The Department of Homeland Security has apparently shut down a key mobile payment account associated with Mt. Gox, the largest Bitcoin exchange. Chris Cohn, the co-founder of online dating service OkCupid, tweeted out an email he received from Dwolla this afternoon. I'm not sure when the story was written. I first saw it 2 days ago, so this afternoon could be Tuesday. The email states that neither Cohn nor presumably any other Dwolla user will be able to transfer funds to Mt. Gox. Dwolla confirmed the change to the New York Observer, which first reported the story. Dweller received a seizure warrant from a federal court. The Department of Homeland Security and U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland issued a seizure warrant for the funds associated with Mutum Siglum Siglum's Dweller account, a.k.a. Mt. Gox. A Dweller spokesperson told New York Online's Beta Beat, Dweller has ceased all account activities for Mutum Siglum, while Dweller's holding partner transferred his balance per the warrant. So, yeah, they gave it to them. So, they stole this guy's Bitcoins.
You know, that's not so much a hit on Bitcoins, because, you know, it's something that everybody's expecting. To me, that's more saying, never use Dweller.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of what we were thinking, though, is they were going to start... Dweller was a brokerage, wasn't it? Like letting you move Bitcoins in and out of other systems, right?
I don't know. I've never even used it.
Anything in the story say why they got a warrant to seize assets?
Actually, that is the next paragraph. It isn't yet clear why this seizure happened, and Dweller isn't saying anything beyond confirming the court order. Mt. Gox didn't immediately respond to an inquiry from ours about the seizure. A user on Bitcoin Stack Exchange published a story reply shortly, A user on Bitcoin Stack Exchange, what? Okay. Published a short reply receiving an inquiry to Mt. Gox about the shutdown. Thank you for the email. We can see that Dweller transactions are not getting processed right now. We will contact Dweller and post an announcement regarding this. Your patience is appreciated till then. A DHS spokeswoman declined to comment on the case in order to not compromise this ongoing investigation being conducted by ICE Homeland Security Investigations Baltimore. Using a payment service like Dweller is one of the easiest ways for U.S. residents to buy Bitcoins. More popular payment services can't be used to buy on the Mt. Gox exchange. PayPal, for instance, can't be used to perform currency exchanges. Mt. Gox is the largest Bitcoin exchange, blah, 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 blah. So, now, this story kind of blew up after the fact, and now a lot of people have it in their heads that Mt. Gox itself was attacked. And, my understanding was it was just the accounts on Mt. Gox that were associated with Dweller, specifically, you know, people buying Bitcoins through them. And this doesn't surprise me at all, because I kind of thought a couple of months ago, is this not exactly what I said? They're not going to attack Bitcoin, they're going to attack all the services associated with it.
Oh, yeah.
But they'd still need a reason to legally seize assets.
I don't know what it is. I saw a couple of stories floating around, but it's so hyped up, it's hard to tell what's really going on. And there are a couple of other articles covering this, and I didn't like any of them other than this very first one from ours. So I haven't been able to really make heads or tails of it just yet. So I think they were charging them with fraud.
Fair enough.
But that, like I said, I skimmed a bunch of articles, and this one turned out to be the best write-up of any of it, because most of them go into hyperbole about the government attacking Mt. Gox, which I don't think is what actually happened.
Well, other than it being a Bitcoin account instead of just standard currency, the government's seized assets for periods of time related to different crimes, like, every day.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree, so... Like I said, I couldn't find a really good article on this outside of this first one. So, yeah, it's confusing because it blew up and now everybody and their brother has something on it and none of it makes any sense. So I'm thinking somebody has charged this Dweller with a fraud of some sort, and to do the investigation, they've just seized all assets, which, like you said, happens all the time. It's probably too. It's probably like, oh, yep, somebody once used a Dweller account to buy something, you know, illegal online, drugs or something through Silk Road. So, yeah, we're just going to seize the whole thing.
Dweller handle multiple accounts?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I just looked up their website. Basically, all they are is a way to move money. It's like PayPal.
They're a PayPal alternative, right?
Yeah. You know, it's like you give them money and they can put it into somebody, another user's account. Like that's all it is.
And they didn't seize a specific user. They seized, like, all of Dwala.
They seized Dwala's account on Mt. Gox, which would be their Bitcoin wallet.
And so this might be slightly more than just seizing an asset. It's like, if they were going after normal cash, they don't go after an entire bank. They go after an account or an exchange associated with a person or a business that's in charge of doing something illegal. If they're seizing an entire bank, then either the bank's under investigation, well, a division of the bank.
I don't think they're recognized as a bank.
No, they're not.
Yeah, they're just an exchange.
Yeah.
So right. I don't know. Like I said, it's hard to get good information on this now because it's all been picked up and seized, and you got the Bitcoin people screaming they're under attack, and you got everybody else saying, you know, just saying, "Oh, what?" So it's hard to sift good information from it. So we'll have to follow it up, I guess.
It's something that's worth keeping your eye on, but it's definitely not something to really be worried about at this point.
Unless you had Bitcoin accounts through Dwala. In that case, the government has your money. Good luck. My understanding is they spend money like drunken sailors, so you'll probably not get it back.
Oh, they'll just print you some more.
God. Yeah, you're probably right. So let's stop picking on our government and pick on the Australian government. This is from delimiter.com.au. The federal government, and this is the Australian government, by the way, has confirmed its financial regulator has started requiring Australian internet service providers to block websites suspected of providing fraudulent financial opportunities, in a move which appears to also open the door for other government agencies to unilaterally block sites they deem questionable in their own portfolios. The news came tonight in a statement issued by the Office of Communications Minister Stephen Conroy following a controversial event in April which saw some 1,200 websites wrongfully blocked by several of Australia's major internet service providers. On April 12th, The Melbourne Times Weekly reported that more than 1,200 websites, including one belonging to independent learning organization Melbourne Free University, might have been blocked by the Australian government. At the time, Melbourne Free University was reportedly told by its ISP, Exetel, that the IP address hosting the website had been blocked by Australian authorities. The block lasted from April 4th until the 12th. Subsequently, the U.S.-based Electronic Frontier Foundation issued a media release linking the issue to the Labor federal government's various internet filtering activities or initiatives, especially the voluntary filtering scheme currently implemented by a number of major ISPs, including Telstra, Optus, and Vodafone. In November last year, Communications Minister Stephen Conroy formally dumped the government's highly controversial mandatory internet filtering scheme, instead throwing his support behind a much more limited scheme, which sees Australian ISPs voluntarily implementing a much more limited filter, which Telstra, Optus, and one or two other ISPs have already implemented. Vodafone also implemented the filter, and the process is also believed to be underway over all other ISPs, such as IINet. The voluntary filter only blocks a set of websites which international policing agency Interpol has verified contain the worst of the worst, child pornography, not the wider refused classification category of content which Conroy's original filter had dealt with. The instrument through which ISPs blah, 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 section 131, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, so what's happened here is the Australian government set up this voluntary block list for ISPs, of course, under the domain of blocking child porn. And now they've gone and changed the rules, saying they can block anything their financial ministry deems to be a scam site, which opens the door for every one of their other federal government agencies to start blocking sites that they don't like.
Yeah.
So,
they always say it's a slippery slope, you know, when they talk about good control and they don't want one little thing to pass. It's because stupid shit like that happens. You let one little freedom go, and then they start taking more and more and more, and before you know, you're fucking locked away in prison.
I'd say that's more a symptom of not having the proper checks and balances in place. You know, like, I see nothing wrong with blocking child pornography sites. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and I fully support it. It's just when you start allowing your government to take more and more control like that, that's when you start running into problems. There should be checks and balances in place that prevent that sort of abuse of power.
Why does government need to give you the list of who the child pornographers are? Why not just have the ISPs do that directly?
Oh, that's fine, but, you know, you're going to end up with ISPs who don't.
So, if you want an ISP that blocks blocks child porn, you will do a business with an ISP that blocks child porn. If Fair you enough. Want an ISP that does not block child porn, then you need to go on a watch list. But that point
well,
aside,
you know, but
that's
like,
entirely up to you.
The same thing can be said, why should the government prevent people from killing each other? You know, like, why don't we just not hang out with the people who kill people? You know, like,
no,
the government's
got to step in. No, I don't think that's an apples-to-apples comparison there, Swap.
Well, no, but, like, the government's got to step in and stop the law from being broken and prevent people from, you know, accessing that sort of stuff. So, you know, I personally don't see any problem with the government preventing people from breaking the law.
Go ahead, Madman.
The only thing I'm going to say to that is they're not the regulation isn't going to prevent child pornographers from disseminating child pornography over the internet. They're just going to change the website they use. But this does allow the government to filter anything they want at all from the internet. They can deem anything they want subversive and take it down when these laws start getting passed. So let's say we start having a legitimate discussion on presidential politics or any type of politics and the party in power doesn't like it, these types of laws allow them to pretty much shut us down.
Only I'm when not... you allow them to. Like, that's what I mean by checks and balances. You know, like, there's nothing wrong with having a law preventing child porn websites. There is something wrong with government abusing their power and blocking websites that they don't like.
All governments abuse their power as soon as they have it. That's why you should limit the amount of power all governments have. The government should only be able to protect my prevent me from harming someone else or destroying or taking their property. Beyond that, it's up to society to govern itself. If the government has leads on who's producing the child pornography, I will personally go there, douse them with gasoline, and set them on fire. But as for regulating what I can see or do on the internet, I'm pornographer, but as soon as you allow that type of filtering, they can stop me from political discussions, economic discussions,
tell me
whatever group of laws they want.
From a different light, why shouldn't I be allowed to go put a large billboard of child pornography up on the wall? But that's against the law. There's laws that prevent you from putting child pornography out in public. To me, there's not really much of a difference from a law preventing you from putting child pornography on a billboard versus child pornography on a website.
Well, okay, but that law already exists.
The law isn't preventing us from putting child pornography on the website. It's saying the government can filter websites. It's already illegal in Australia to put child pornography on a website. It was illegal before this law passed. All this law allows the government to do is filter the internet. They can filter it for anything they want once they do that. So the difference between what you're saying and what they're saying is it's already illegal to put the child pornography on the internet.
Fair enough. I'll give you that point.
Okay.
So I think they should just spend the resources on tracking down actual child pornographers, either more money going to Interpol for Europe, you know, moving across state borders or whatever, and track people down and start putting bullets in their heads.
Now, you know, to be fair, I don't have a problem with Interpol giving a list of bad websites to ISPs and then ISPs voluntarily blocking them. And they say it's a voluntary list. The problem I have is now the Australian government is saying, well, we can put whatever we want on that list. Because at least with Interpol, you've kind of got a third party going on. You know what I mean? I mean, it's
the Australian government is checking Interpol because Interpol's not actually part of the Australian government.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. I mean, Interpol's government agency. Don't get me wrong, but I mean, it's several governments, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, there's at least some checks there, and you know, I honestly wouldn't have a big complaint with ISPs getting a list of bad URLs and blocking them. I just want them to be very, very, very careful about that, because the Google anti-malware stuff is very overzealous. And you'll find websites that are blocked. There's nothing wrong with them, but they're blocked. And a lot of people think that's political. So,
well, very often it's just they had an ad on their site like 6 months ago that had some malware in it, and it's all been cleared up. But of course, they're still on the blocked list. I think, you know, it can be valuable having something on there that'll block like malware and stuff like that. Absolutely.
It's the thing is, I don't want them. I understand it, especially from a network administration perspective. But that said, you've really got to be careful where you draw that line, right? It's really needs to be something the ISPs are managing and not a government, because, well, like I agree with Madman that once you give a government potential for abuse, it probably will eventually happen. Just think. You know, okay, throw the child porn versus politics you don't like out. You know, for whatever reason, we now have the ability to filter the internet, right? You know, legally. Well, what's to stop the RIAA, MPAA, or whatever mafia you want from coming in and giving that government a hell of a lot of money, and suddenly now, you know, all this, you know, piracy, anything deemed as, you know, related to piracy is now blocked, period, full stop, at the ISP level. Like BitTorrent, well, just blocked, period, full stop. So even
you're going to see a huge boom in the VPN industry.
There's that. But you see, now what that is that's not that that's subverting your government. That's not fixing your government. That's just going to the black market to get it, as opposed to getting it fought for whatever to be legal again.
And you know, like, I guess that kind of comes down to it's a bad idea to make laws that you cannot enforce. just like in China, it's commonplace. Like, everybody and their grandmother knows how to use a VPN. Like, everybody in the country with an internet connection uses a VPN at this point, pretty much. And it's not like you have to be like tech savvy or anything like that. Everybody knows how to use it because it's part of your daily life.
Yeah. Oh, well, hell, let's go completely off the rails here. Speaking of government writing laws they can't enforce, I was talking with the guy I work with today about guns, because I'm thinking about going and getting a handgun. And he was showing me that there's this group of people who buy AR-15 handguns. And what they actually are AR-15s where the stock's been removed and they put a short barrel on it and they call it a handgun. And
why would you shoot that? It's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt you.
It's, oh God, you wouldn't believe it. They had a chin mount so that they wasn't, you know, so there wasn't a stock against the shoulder. It had this little stock that came out of the back of the gun and went on your chin. And just because if it's a stock against the shoulder, that means it's a rifle. But if it's not against the shoulder, the stock can be somewhere else. It was just like,
I want to use my chin to absorb the recoil.
Yeah, it didn't seem wise. It's like, oh, well, there went your teeth. But I mean,
what government were they subverting? Because it's easier to get a rifle in the U.S. than a handgun.
I don't know. But the thing is, people were wanting a short AR-15. But so, I mean, I asked him, so what's to stop me from buying one of these AR-15 pistols and just putting a stock on the damn thing? Now I've got a rifle with a short barrel, because the whole thing was related to the length of the barrel, right? And he said, well, you're violating the law, but other than that, nothing, because it's the same damn gun.
Get a little collapsible stock, shortened a barrel. This is a trench coat gun.
Yeah, that's the idea.
I'm wrong. This was a good idea. Whoever came up with the AR-15 handgun, I might buy one just so I can fix its two problems.
But I mean, yeah, the whole unenforceable laws, I mean, they're WIM laws, right? At that point, you can claim somebody's violating them and pick them up and, you know, welcome to the police state. So,
well, it's easier to police a population when everyone's guilty.
Yeah, like
that
Japan.
Is true.
Just go in, lock somebody up because they're guilty. I've hit play on a YouTube video. I am guilty.
You're not supposed to own up to that shit, dude.
What, hitting play on a YouTube video?
Absolutely. What the fuck is wrong with you? That's like a confession right there.
That's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. As soon as I hit play, I committed at least two acts of piracy.
You're not supposed to be talking about committing crimes, man. Come on.
That's what the aliases.
When did
they
even need that to arrest you nowadays?
Yeah, these flimsy aliases we all use are really gonna.
Yeah. I'm also banking on no one from the government ever listening to your podcast.
God, I hope not. Okay, let's just go ahead. We're half an hour into the show here. Disclaimer, if you are a member of a government organization, you do not have permission to listen to our show. Thank you.
That one that holds now. Up in the court.
It's an it's a EULA. They agreed to it by opening the show. They agreed they were not a member of a government organization. The only way they can listen to the show is if they quit right now.
Now, they can keep their job. They just have to become a double agent for us.
Nice. Okay. Where was
I? I'd like to know when the vans are going to show up at my house.
That would be in 5, 4, 3. Anyways, next story.
I don't know. If we're done with the child pornography and no one's shown up yet, I think we're safe. And by that, I meant discussing it, not actually filming it or doing anything illegal.
You know, it's sad that you even had to clarify that.
Yeah.
All right, next story up. This one's from H Online. The New Yorker magazine has launched Strongbox, an anonymous dead drop site that allows people to share messages and files anonymously with the writers and editors of the magazine. It does this in part by only being accessible through the Tor network. Based on the DeadDrop software, a free software platform written by Aaron Swartz, the application allocates every source a code name. It is this code name which allows the source to be contacted without revealing their identity. Each incoming document is GPG encrypted before storage. Journalists see each different code name, and communications are grouped into collections related to this anonymous identifier. The hardware behind the system requires three physical servers. One is a public-facing server, another was tasked with storing information, and the third monitors the security of the other two servers. The New Yorker installation also has an entropy key plugged into the public-facing server. Strongbox originated in 2011 with a meeting at the Wired offices between Aaron Swartz and Kevin Paulson. According to... Or is it Paulson? Did I say that right? Paulson?
I'm
going to
go
Paulson?
With yes.
I'm just, you know...
Name
his name
was Robert
Kevin
Paulson.
Paulson. Yeah. According to an article in the New Yorker... Oh, because we don't have enough Fight Club references in this show already.
Hey, we don't talk about that here.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
That's violating the first two rules.
Yeah. Yeah. The dead drop system became a back burner project for both, and over 2011, James Dolan, a security expert, convinced three of his industry colleagues to help ensure that the system was anonymous and secure. Stable code and a planned launch date were set in December 2012, but the death of Swartz brought a halt to the project. Swartz's intellectual property was willed to Sean Palmer, who has since blessed the project, and Swartz executors said his family and friends approve of the launch of Strongbox. The installation scripts and setup instructions, including how to harden a Ubuntu environment to run it, produced by James Dolan, are included with DeadDrop. The project is available to fork from GitHub. Although the project was designed to make secure DeadDrop systems available to all, at this point, the developers do need that to say that expertise is needed to safely deploy it, and the actual code still needs more work. The first implementation now running at the New Yorker, the software will see more practical use and hopefully fulfill its design goals. So essentially what they've made is a file system, a file upload system via Tor that assigns a unique identifier or code name to an individual source, the goal of this is obviously to allow somebody to be a whistleblower without actually revealing who they are to the journalists they're whistleblowing to. And of course, this came out because of the AP phone tap bullshit going on right now. So, yeah, at this point, pretty much just assume somebody is spying on you, whether it's the government or Skype or Microsoft or who's pinging.
Sorry.
Who has the machine that goes ping?
Sorry.
Are you keeping somebody alive over there? Is it yours?
His coffee's done.
That's not nearly as interesting as what I had in my mind. So, yeah, the New Yorker set up this dead drop system, which is kind of interesting that they've wrapped a whole bunch of open source code and put this together. My only question is, how the hell are you going to get most of these whistleblowers to even have a clue how to use the Tor network?
They're going to have classes, and then the software is going to get in the hands of everyone else that uses Tor.
Fair point.
I mean, so. I hate the idea that this would be necessary, and I'm not entirely sure that it is, but I can see legitimate uses for it. I am kind of scared about complete anonymity on a whistleblower, because for a newspaper to run with the story, I think they need to be able to check that the whistleblower is credible. Like, if I show up to a newspaper and say, I have evidence that the CIA is using fillings and cavities to spy on us.
But Mythbusters disproved that theory.
Well, yeah, well, but to be fair, a good journalist is going to check those sources. So, like, if somebody provides them with some documents saying, you know, something sketchy is going on, that's not the only thing that they're going to use to report this.
I don't know, dude.
They're a good journalist.
I've got a copy of Photoshop, and I can make some pretty convincing-looking NSA documentation.
Well, that's why you have to verify your sources.
But I know how these people write. Sources,
but, well, no, I know. I'm just saying, like, that's what a good journalist does.
Suave, I want you to show me an actual good journalist nowadays.
they're a dying breed.
I'm certain they exist somewhere.
In that fantasy land where unicorns exist.
This is going to make it harder for a good journalist to actually verify anything if they don't know who they're talking to.
There's a lot of truth there.
At least, I'm going at this, they're trying to protect whistleblowers. So let's say I'm a government employee and I noticed some bullshit with the government that's like completely off the walls and the public needs to know.
Soylent Green is people. Okay.
Soylent Green is people. The odds of me getting documentation out, okay, let's say I can even do that. The only thing that gives that documentation legitimacy is the fact that I can show, hi, I worked for the government, and you're not going to be able to get anyone else to legitimize this because they'll go to prison, they'll get shot, they'll get turned into Soylent Green, their careers will be ruined, whatever. But I'm the ballsy motherfucker willing to do it. Just don't tell anyone who I am. That lends it enough credence, I think, for a responsible journalist to go with it if they can just verify who this guy is somehow. I don't know, just show him the badge or whatever the hell. But if it's completely anonymous, then documents, they're really easy to fake. I mean, you don't even need Photoshop. Government uses open source software or commercial software to create their internal documents. It's Word.
Well, actually, you want Photoshop for faking the badge, that and a nice high-res shot of an NSA. Anyways, that's not hard at all, by the way. Take a picture of somebody else's badge, Photoshop it, reprint it. Yeah.
The whistleblower, the only thing that gives them credence is who they are. Because you can't verify it. And responsible journalists are supposed to verify everything they do. But if it's a government whistleblower or even a corporate whistleblower, you're not going to easily get verification on anything they're telling you. So it's literally their word against whatever they're blowing the whistle on.
Well, I definitely see your point there. So, got another Ars Technica story here. Last week, Microsoft released a YouTube client for Windows Phone that gave users of Redmond smartphone a rich, capable YouTube experience that didn't depend on using the YouTube mobile site. Though the app included support or included account support, playlists, commenting, and other aspects of YouTube, there was one thing that was missing: advertising. It also had two features it shouldn't have had: the ability to download videos and the ability to play the videos that the creators have blocked from mobile devices. As a result, Google sent Microsoft a cease and desist order demanding that the company stop distribution of the application by May 22nd. The letter, addressed to Senior Director of Windows Phone Apps Team Todd Bricks, said that by blocking advertising and allowing downloads of videos, your application cuts off a valuable ongoing revenue source for creators and causes harm to the thriving ecosystem of YouTube. Microsoft put out a mobile application for Windows Phone that did not show YouTube's ads, and YouTube pissed their pants.
So they had ad blocker on it.
It wasn't even ad blocker, it just ignored them.
I'm fine with that. I could see them saying you can't, the program shouldn't be able to download or copy our videos, but blocking ads? If I'm paying for an app that blocks ads, I want an app that blocks ads.
Fair enough.
I'm sure people weren't paying for it.
I think it was just part of Windows Phone, but I cut off a bit of the story.
I paid for it when I bought the phone.
Yeah. I cut off a bit of the story. Microsoft was saying, look, YouTube cut off a lot of their API service, so we had to hack it. What do you expect? But, yeah. So, and of course, Google's response is basically quit it.
Well, you know, I'm sure there's some sort of, like, violation of terms of use for doing something like that.
Like, oh, absolutely. I just loved how Google's excuse was, you're hurting people who depend on YouTube advertising. Yeah, you know, like YouTube.
Well, and to be fair, you know, there are actually a rapidly growing number of video bloggers and stuff like that who are making a living on YouTube. So, you know, like, it is actually a valid source of income now for a lot of people.
So you're saying we need more Galaxy 15 radio content on YouTube?
Yeah.
Well, first we actually need to get a large base of listeners.
So we take the Badger video and edit out the music, and just put our
like
radio show as
already.
The soundtrack. I'm certain there are still people that type in Badger just to see the video. Or to leave it playing on someone else's machine. We're going to get hits.
Wow. All right. Next story up. This one's just fun. It's from Business Insider. LinkedIn just rolled out a number of changes to its privacy policy and user agreement, informing its more than 200 million members to a notice on the professional network's website. Most of the changes are a simplification of the legalese, but one in particular caught our eye. According to LinkedIn, thou shalt not, even if it is legal where you are located, create profiles or provide content that promotes escort services or prostitution. What surprised us was that this was even necessary. Excuse me. On a site where every action you take is tied to your professional identity, why would anybody really take the risk of advertising adult services? Apparently, people do. Prostitution, in fact, is a skill for which you can get endorsed on LinkedIn.
It's a profession.
This person's a fantastic whore!
Please
Many
say they leave that in.
Huh? What'd you say, Matt Ben?
I said, please say they're leaving this in.
Many self-identified experts on the topic work in law enforcement or religious ministries, suggesting that their experience is catching or counseling offenders rather than offering some services. Judging by suggestions in LinkedIn search algorithms, judging by the suggestions LinkedIn's search algorithm offers, LinkedIn members are actively looking for this kind of professional help. Search for escorts, for example, and LinkedIn will prompt you to search instead for the following terms: female escorts, independent escorts, call girls, hot girls, adult entertainment, escort services, or Dubai escorts. It's like they singled out Dubai. That's fantastic. This ban is not completely new. LinkedIn previously forbade advertising unlawful services. However, prostitution is legal in some European countries, and escort services fall into a legal gray area in many jurisdictions. The clarification appears necessary, as some LinkedIn members appear to have been skirting the order to offer risque business. So you can't get your hookers on LinkedIn, apparently.
What if I run the Bunny Ranch? It's a completely legitimate licensed business, and all of my whores be a doctor weekly.
and are checked out.
Well, it's like, isn't it legal in Vegas?
Yeah, that's where the Bunny Ranch is. Well, it's legal in Nevada. It's not legal in Las Vegas City itself. You have to go outside the city limits. That's why the Bunny Ranch is, like, I think, 10 miles outside of city limits.
Yeah, I just...
Not that I'm researching this for my trip to Las Vegas or anything.
He's been looking things up. this is right up with Craigslist trying to stop this shit, too. It's like, yes, people are going to abuse your service and use it in ways you don't like. Guess what?
If it's illegal in the area they're advertising it in, you're hindering the police's ability to track it. I think, let's say, I want to get a prostitute in Chicago, Illinois. I think it's still illegal there. Probably still illegal there. And I go to LinkedIn and put in call girls in Chicago, and I actually get addresses. Maybe the cops should be going to those addresses and being like, hi, will you slob on my knob for $25 and then arresting some people?
I'm not sure if that's entrapment or not.
They advertised on LinkedIn. It's not entrapment. They initiated the service.
Well, the slob on the knob comment is actually what I'm wondering about there. But
you have to negotiate these things some way, and I'm thinking a prostitute won't believe a cop is going to use the phrase slob on my knob. You have to put her at ease just before you put the handcuffs on her. I mean, if you're submissive, doesn't trust you fully, or at least, doesn't trust you fully, they'll resist whenever you're putting them in the back of the car.
No, it's just a costume. I'm just really into the role-playing thing. Ways to get shot, 101. Let's see.
Yeah, I think the police force, before LinkedIn actually starts enforcing this, should use their services.
What they already do on Facebook, don't they? I mean, like, watch for people saying, hey, just robbed a bank, lol, YOLO.
Oh, it's funny because it's true.
I've just been informed I've made yet another soundbite for somebody's board. Nice.
Yeah, well, okay, last story I got for tonight. This one's from NPR. A new rifle goes on sale Wednesday, and it's not like any other. It uses lasers and computers to make shooters very accurate. A startup gun company in Texas developed the rifle, which is so effective that some in the shooting community say it should not be sold to the public. It's called the Tracking Point Rifle. On a firing range just outside Austin in the city of Liberty Hill, a novice shooter holds one and takes aim at a target 500 yards away. Normally, it takes years of practice to hit something at that distance, but this shooter nails it on the first try. The rifle's scope features a sophisticated color graphics display. The shooter locks a laser on the target by pushing a small button by the trigger. It's like a video game. God, I love the comparison. But here's where it's different. You pull the trigger, but the gun decides when to shoot. It fires only when the weapon has been pointed exactly at the right place, taking into account dozens of available variables, including wind, shake, and distance to the target. The rifle has a built-in laser rangefinder, a ballistics computer, and a Wi-Fi transmitter to stream live video and audio to a nearby iPad. Every shot is recorded so it can be replayed or posted to YouTube or Facebook.
Why just did they need bank, that last YOLO. Feature?
Wow.
Why am I happily scared that this gun exists? Or this scope exists? Because I think it's all done in the scope.
It probably is. But, I mean, I love the... It's not so much that they have the onboard computer that the gun is timing when to shoot so that it gets exactly the perfect conditions for a shot. Because that's good, legitimate military technology. It's the whole streaming it to your iPad so you can laugh at the guy falling over and post it to YouTube.
But that's the older technology. Hunters have been using that for years now. What scares me is the gun's deciding when to shoot. I don't want the gun to think. That scares me. Machines shouldn't think.
It's not thinking. It's just following a program.
Billy, run! It's locked on! I can't go!
No,
it's
thinking.
You saw a laser point at my head.
It's thinking, and that's the defense I'm going to use whenever I'm finally taken to court. I swear, Your Honor, my fingerprints might be on the trigger, but the gun fired itself.
Talk about flaming the gun.
Well, now I might be able to pull off a legitimate argument for that.
The gun can now think. It has
guns don't
will.
Kill people, computers kill people.
When you attach them to guns, yeah! What's the price tag on this gun?
I don't remember. It was expensive. Hang on a second. Let me pull that story up because it was in there. $22,000.
Oh.
Yeah.
I could get a 50 cal for that much. I could get a 50 cal at Whitaker's for that much.
I think I'd rather have a 50 cal.
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem going to a range and getting good again with a gun.
I can practice with the 50 cal, or I can buy the gun that'll do it for me.
Well, let's see. How many rounds on a 50 cal would that scope cost?
And to be fair, it's going to be pretty expensive to practice on a 50 cal.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering, why is the scope doing its own math? This seems like something you could take advantage of that iPad that's recording your sniper videos. So when you shoot the president, you can upload it to YouTube with YOLO as a tag. And, wow, did I just say that?
Oh, thank you were yes. Going into a camp now. Say goodbye to Morps.
Think the following that ZC Sniper would have had if he had this gun. The revenue on YouTube would have gone through the roof.
Yeah, in the advertiser program, this is why Microsoft can't ban the ads. I mean, my God.
Hey, look, there's a live stream of this speech going on.
Oh, man. Oh,
you'll get the next Siege of Waco from both perspectives.
Hey, this it'll be fair and balanced.
You'll get the news that the cops want you to see, and you'll get all the video that the snipers on the roofs are streaming. Oh, I need to buy this gun before I finally go completely nuts.
Okay, that's enough of that. I think it's time for this. Yo! All right, for Digital Dojo tonight, a couple of weeks ago, Laura asked me to take a look at BitTorrent Sync, or BT Sync. And if you go to labs.bittorrent.com, switch experiments, switch sync.html, you can pull down the client. This thing is still beta. I want to point that out. But what it does is it will sync two folders across the internet, sort of like Dropbox, pretty much. It'll just keep the files in them the same. But it uses the BitTorrent protocol to do so. And there's not really an upper limit on file size or data or the number of people who can be sharing a folder, because it's all done over BitTorrent. It's all peer-to-peer. There's really not much of a central server involved. Of course, they got versions for Windows and Mac, and they got just about every SKU of Linux you could think of, versions of this client. The Windows and Mac versions are kind of GUI-based. They look like Dropbox. Well, no, that's not true. They don't look like Dropbox, say... They've got a GUI. I mean, you know, they've run a little client, and you tell it what folders to keep in sync. And it'll give you what they call a secret or a hash for each folder. And you can share this out. and you can get what it calls a read-only secret or a full secret. A full secret would be that the two folders are kept in sync. A read-only secret means that whoever you give that one to is going to download your folder, and any changes you make to the folder will show up on their machine, but any changes they make will not be. So you can actually build some sort of a content distribution system with this. You know, we could, in theory, throw this out there and say put all the Pure Decking episodes in a folder and throw out a read-only key. And you could throw it in this client, and you would just get every new episode as we added it.
And that's pretty awesome.
It's a nice program. It is fairly early. Personally, the hash, I think, is on the short side. Their secrets, it only looks like it's 64 characters, give or take. So I think you could brute it. I think it would take a lot of effort. But you could potentially brute every key and watch every, you know, for every file showing up, right? I mean, this would take a lot of effort and a lot of work to do it, but I think it could be done. But in their forums, they're already talking about fixing it. They're already talking about longer hashes and some customization. So you might be able to get a very specific hash, or at least feed it some more information rather than just the ones it generates. Privacy-wise, this thing is pretty good. Privacy-wise, this thing is really good potential. I think you would have to do some work to it to get it really, really, truly private. For one thing, you'd have to run your own BitTorrent tracker, because it does use a BitTorrent tracker to connect up your machines. But that does mean that you've got this kind of man-in-the-middle aspect of it, so you don't necessarily have to open up ports in your firewall. You don't have to, and you don't necessarily even have to run your own tracker. There are other trackers out there. By default, it's using its own. And when I was goofing around with it, I noticed a couple of things. There's no encryption that's provided, you know, in the software. And it's hashing it when it's talking to the tracker just to connect up to the two machines. But it's not. It didn't appear to anyways be sending out a list of what files it was syncing up. It was just kind of, you know, client A, meet client B, you're both on the same hash, that kind of thing. So the tracker knows who is talking to who, but it doesn't appear to see what they can see. But even if you're worried about that, you know, you can TrueCrypt or something like that. But it didn't have any built-in encryption. But I mean, you could layer it. And if you are worried about people being able to see your IP, you probably need something like a VPN or a Tor or an I2P in front of it, because whoever set up the initial folder is going to get a list of everyone who's connected to it. So, you know, if you got a group doing a project, no big deal. But if you're distributing stuff on the sly, you might kind of want to set up a server somewhere that you don't care that the IP gets out. You know, that's back to our conversation last week about controlling what information goes out and what doesn't. So, and you need good OPSEC, because if you give somebody the everything key and they go deleting everything, well, guess what? It all disappears. So back to that content distribution idea. If we were to put out a folder with every episode of Pure Decking and we accidentally published the full key, well, one, anything anybody else dropped in that folder would show up on everyone's machine. And two, anything you deleted would just disappear, from including the original machine. Make sense?
Yeah.
Because it's a full folder sync. It's kind of like rsync, except it uses the BitTorrent protocol instead of its own. Yeah. So, but it does generate these read-only secrets, which are kind of neat, and that you could make a CDN with it. And it is BitTorrent, so as you add more clients, you get more bandwidth. And I have to say, I was actually surprised by the speed of it. I was expecting it to be really slow when I was testing it, because generally BitTorrent, you know, you need that kind of critical mass of 100 or so people on there in various parts of the world to really get good bandwidth. But for just the handful of machines I was goofing around with it on, the speed was pretty good. So, yeah. I should point out the Linux versions actually use a little web interface instead of a GUI on the system, because they're actually intended for server style. So, It's not a direct Dropbox replacement, but you could kind of make it one. You know what I mean? You could set up a Linux server somewhere, make sure they have good bandwidth and hard drive space, and then share out secrets from that one and into all your other machines to kind of build your own Dropbox replacement. It's not a drop-in replacement, but it's certainly something you could use to build your own replacement. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, making sure I'm making, because I'm kind of rambling a little bit here. But it did kind of open up some fun ideas. If you wanted to collaborate with a group of people, it'd be fairly easy way to do it. Pretty good. There's no versioning, so you know whatever the last version somebody wrote into the folder, that's the one that gets shared out. So you know, like a GitHub might be better if you're doing programming projects. But for what we do with G15, especially some of the audio work, it could actually be really handy to put like raw files in there and have it get shared out to everybody who's editing stuff. So like when somebody's chopping up the bits, so we can cut, you know, when they can pull out the clips of, you know, Madman, what was it that you told you were being put into a soundboard on?
I don't know what clip in that conversation we had he pulled, but are you pulled some clips of us for a soundboard?
Well, he could make a folder and share it out over the BT sync, and we could all get it, so we could then have those clips, you know, for just for whatever. If you wanted to trim it up, maybe he left a little bit of fuzz on the end of it, you could clean it up and it would get shared back out to everybody. But you know, the thing you got to watch out for again is the good OPSEC, because you could share it out to somebody who doesn't like the station, so they go in and, you know, just record somebody saying something offensive over and over and over again instead of the clip they're expecting. You know,
like it would be kind of like what we play on the station.
So yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I really want to see this thing evolve a little bit. I do want people to understand this is not a direct replacement for something like a Dropbox. This is more like an rsync. But, you know, it also got me thinking, this thing's going to be a hell on security, right? Because you don't really have to open up ports to it. It uses a tracker to be kind of beacon out. So there's not really much to stop you from, say, taking a Raspberry Pi with a USB hard drive, or just an old laptop, and just hiding it somewhere with nice bandwidth, and suddenly you've got a file server that's shared out to keep stuff in sync with everybody. And with the read-only keys, it'd be nothing to post them out on a forum somewhere, and now you're distributing your media. Completely subversive.
I like your thinking.
I mean, or even just get you a VPN or another server somewhere that you don't particularly care about that you can run code on. And yeah, now you've got a distribution network that's going out via BitTorrent. So if nothing else, it's channels that people aren't expecting, and you can distribute whatever the hell you want. Or you could build your own Dropbox style replacement. The only thing you got to keep in mind is this thing is peer to peer. So, you know, for example, with Dropbox, if I've only got one computer on at a time, but you know, maybe five computers that are syncing up to a Dropbox account, it doesn't matter that I never power up more than one of them at a time, because they all sync up to a central server, right? Well, with BT Sync, if both machines aren't on, the sync doesn't happen, and they both need to have a fairly decent internet connection. So this is why we talk about setting up a server somewhere. And really, to be truly private, you need to run your own BitTorrent tracker and tell your BT Sync to use your tracker instead of the built-in one, because then you're controlling where the traffic goes from all angles. So you could build a truly private file sharing system with this thing. You just need really good OPSEC and a little bit of infrastructure. So I'm like, it's going to be a security nightmare, because how do you catch this thing in your network, right? And if I was malicious, let's say I got into your network maliciously, I could set up BT Sync on some of your servers and just, you know, like hide it so you can't tell that it's there, and just be able to drop in whatever I want on your servers, and it just gets synced right up, especially if I've, you know, dropped off a laptop somewhere at a Starbucks and duct taped it under a table, and it's, you know, acting as my file server. So when you finally track it down, oh, it was going to Starbucks. Well, fuck. So... But Laura asked me to take a look at this, and I'm pleasantly surprised with it. I was expecting it to be a lot more kludgy, a lot less usable. But there's definitely potential with this thing. I don't see it as being a direct replacement for anything right off the bat. But I'm probably going to set this up on the G15 broadcast box and set it up so that several of us... oh, we're losing Sard. Too bad. I was kind of wanting to get his opinion on this BT Sync. And there he goes. But, yeah, I mean, you could definitely see potential for setting some services up with this thing. And I'm probably going to set one up on our broadcast system so that we can more easily move stuff around in it and maybe work on a few projects together. If nothing else, bumpers for the station, because good Lord, we need to make some new ones. So... I don't know about you guys, but I have a hard time understanding like half of the robot voices that we're playing on the stream.
It's a acquired talent. Just need to learn the robot voice.
Yeah. All right. So, of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Sard and Big are always looking for new music to add. So, of course, use the feedback form. Let us know about new music. Pure Decking every Thursday. I don't know. I Shoot the Noise is on hiatus. Where are you on NR7 there, BSV?
It's still going to be an odd schedule, but due to extra free time, I should hopefully be doing a show Monday. No guarantees. But I should try.
Cool. Of course, I have nothing on Saturdays, and now the Missing Dialogues on Tuesdays. Hit up the Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handle, the subreddit, the IRC, the feedback form, sending mental telepathy to Madman. He can receive that this week. And
I don't know if you want to connect to Madman.
Yeah, well... there are worse people to connect to. So.
I was looking at that scope. It's Big Game Hunt, the real edition. It's a video game. They turned shooting people into a video game.
Do they have a point readout on the scope?
I'm sure it's easy enough to hack it.
I think you can put a min-map on it.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm going to hit play on this music now.